So in 1979, George Romero is approached by a couple of film executives. We say, we've got the rights for this book. We think he'd be right. And the reason they think he'd be right is the fact he'd made a film that was quite similar. So he goes to the meeting and he finds out it's actually Salem's Lot. And the film they're referring to wasn't Dawn of the Dead, but was in actual fact Martin. The connection just being that, you know, Romero was reasonably hot at the time because of the success of Dawn. And Martin was about small town vampires, potentially anyway, if you cast your mind back to that film, you know, that's not necessarily clear what Martin is. Romero sort of, he agrees, and because he hits it off with Stephen King, who's very much on board with the project at that time. King wants to potentially write the script, and is a big fan of Romero, and the two start talking and build a friendship. So the plan, as is to make Salem's Lot for the big screen. Obviously, as we know, that doesn't happen. Salem's Lot actually becomes a TV movie filmed by Toby Hooper. At the point that switch changes and it stops being theatrical, Romero steps away and King kind of steps back as well. And it kind of becomes what it is, which is, you know, to be fair, a classic bit of American TV movie history. See, the thing is, though, that Romero really, really wants to make The Stand as a film. But they know it would be impossible to make it in its current form. Without a lot of money. So, because, you know, even though it's, you know, Dawn of the Dead was post-apocalyptic, the type of scale and grandeur that The Stand would need for the big screen was a lot more. And it's unlikely that we're going to get the cash for that, in fairness, straight away. So what happens is Romero approaches King with a different idea. Not an adaptation of one of his books, but the plan of making a film about, almost like an anthology film about the history of horror films. So one segment would be like a black and white movie, one would be like Hint at William Castle Scares, and maybe one would be 3D. King didn't like the idea, but did suggest instead that, considering the fact that both of them were fans of EC Comics, they could do an anthology about that instead.
Coming soon. Jolting Tales of Horror. Creepshow. From the author of Carrie, The Shining, and Cujo. And the creator of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. You'll scream at ghastly ghouls. Cringe at weird kids and shiver at the doings of evil doctors.
This is going to be extremely painful, Mr. Verrill.
Creepshow will grab you, grow on you, and give you the creeps.
No, this is going to be an entirely new experience.
Creepshow, the most fun you'll ever have being scared.
So very quickly, I mean, I know I've done a podcast about horror comics, but EC Comics were quite notorious in the 50s, and entirely because they were pitched at kids, but not really that suitable. So they had sex and violence and gore. And it was, you know, these were morality tales, but done in a way that was quite grisly, shall we say. And yeah, and if you want to know more about the history of that stuff, there is a podcast in this series about that. So King, basically in 60 days, goes off and writes the script, which consists of 5 stories and a wraparound, kind of, you know, buffer, open and close and buffer. Unlike a lot of anthology stories, that the buffer doesn't kind of go in between each story, it just bookends the film to kind of add a bit of context. Stories very quickly are a prologue and epilogue, which is stars Tom Atkins and Joe King, who's we now know as Joe Hill, I suppose, the writer who did Nosferatu and Horns. And Lock and Key, who is Stephen King's son and a famous writer in his own right now. If you want to give any of his stuff a go, 21st Century Ghost Stories is an excellent starting point. After that, we have a story about a monster that comes back from the grave to revenge his death with his horrible family. And that features a still unfamous Ed Harris, who still at this point had not made the right stuff, and but obviously was part of the Romero crew at that stage, because he'd been in Knight Riders, although I think Ed Harris sees it more doing a favour for George than the other way around. He certainly wasn't the big Hollywood star that we now know. That's followed by Stephen King starring in his own section, the lonesome death of Joe Duvall. Then there's a very, very, very much an EC comic style story of Something to Tide You Over, with Leslie Nielsen just giving it beans, and Ted Danson and Galen Ross with a kind of a horrible way to die, and a revenge as well. Hal Holbrook stars as Henry in The Crate, about a monster in a university that can be used to kill. And The Creeping Up on You, which is probably the most Romero-esque part of the film, starring E.G. Marshall as a very rich, racist, horrible man who is determined to keep the flat clean, but the cockroaches around him have a different idea. So it's 2 hours, and it's an anthology format. The thing about it is, and I think a lot of people think it's quite a major film or a major release. I mean, when it was made, it wasn't. I mean, it was certainly a lot more money than Romero had had before. So Romero had, because of the names, Romero was obviously able to make a good quality film with Dawn, and was on his up and quite famous at this stage. And Stephen King was already a reasonable force, and Carrie had been made as a film to prove that there was an interest in that. So in terms of producing the movie, Richard Rubenstein didn't struggle perhaps as much as he might have done it previously to get the cash. But it was still filmed very much like a Romero production. It was filmed in and around Pittsburgh, with most of the film actually shot in an empty girls' school out in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. With the actual school itself converted into a film studio, and where the lonesome death of Jody Verrill and The Creeping Up on You was actually kind of all was shot effectively. And Tom Savini again came back, in this case not as his as an actor, but instead as his special effects guy, and he set up a lab within the school to kind of build these the effects. And now, from Savini's point of view, this was a fantastic situation for him, because he'd effectively become famous because he was for making gore effects look realistic, like Maniac, Friday the 13th, and The Burning. But, you know, he didn't want to be just tied to that kind of stuff. So instead, as well, he was able to create, you know, with this, monsters as well. So the impressiveness of Fluffy from the crate, which is, you know, a mixture of suit and puppetry. And the actual ghoul, the creep show ghoul at the start of the film, is a real skeleton rigged up as a puppet, which they purposed and then changed, which is quite grim when you think about it, but an impressive work nonetheless. And, you know, it was beyond just, you know, splatter effects. The stuff with Ted dancing in underwater, and all those effects were very cleverly done and really, you know, quite brave on Danson's part, because, you know, he is underwater at that point with various ways of kind of getting the water out if it needed to be, but still quite scary. So Romero used a mixture of people he knows. So Savini does get a cameo, in fairness to him. He's one of the garbage men in the story at the start. John Amplus, who pops up again and again and again in Knight Rider, he's Martin in Martin. Appears as a stunt effect guy, as the corpse of Nathan, played by John Lorimer in the Father's Day episode. Obviously, Ed Harris, who plays Hank, pops up as well. But very much it's very clear that although the decision was made to make these characters, make the actors quite impressive, in truth. You know, Hal Holbrook, E.G. Marshall, Leslie Nielsen. What it means is, although obviously, you know, this is pre-Naked Gun Leslie Nielsen as well, what it means is that there's an element of weight and gravitas to it. The actors are able to kind of give more heightened performances, which helps the narrative, but also allows an element of quality and weight. So this isn't this is a proper film. I do wonder what some of these guys who kind of like obviously been flown over to Pittsburgh thought about all this. You know, you've kind of got Stephen King's involved. Obviously, though, you know, bear in mind this is quite early on in King's career, so we've been seen as being quite an unusual character. Romero's there, and it's all being filmed in a school, but it's obvious that there's a lot of money sloshing around. It's a proper, although low budget to a point, I'd call it a mid-budget film. It just so happens it's the exact opposite of where you normally make this kind of stuff. Romero, in a lot of interviews about it, kind of says that, actors were a little bit hesitant, and then when they realised they were serious, that this wasn't a tax dodge, or it was a proper film, and it was clear it was a proper film, calmed down a bit as well. So I think that probably answers that. I'm not going to go through each individual story and talk about it as such. I think it's probably best just to kind of give an overarching feel for the film and what it's trying to achieve. So you've got this opening prologue and epilogue, which is a fairly standard revenge thing that sets up the idea of stories within a comic book, and they could be ghoulish and garish, I suppose, but also that parents would be outraged by them, for those that didn't remember DC Comics from the 50s. The stories themselves very much feel like comics, any kind of comic booky anyway. Now Romero does a lot of stuff that to kind of make that more pronounced, but just the stories themselves are classic kind of morality stories or revenge stories. I think there's a little less sexualization than you'd get in a in a classic EC comic. You know, there's not many knife throws assistants in tight outfits and stuff like that. You know, there's not necessarily that kind of sexualized gore, which did appear a bit in EC, but instead what you get is rich people getting their comeuppance in Father's Day. And bear in mind, a zombie theme as well. In fact, King does this twice. There's two times people return from the grave to kind of gain their revenge, which in fairness is a classic EC comic kind of trope. But at the same time, it does make me smile. It's kind of a, you know, could you be any more EC comic? You know, could you be any more a fan of Romero? You know, I'm going to write a Romero script. We better get some zombies in here at some point. The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill, I will talk about. It's the Stephen King one. It's the one that kind of... Anthologies always get this, you know, the story that doesn't quite fit. You know, oh, I really liked X, Y, and Z, but, you know, A, C, and D, phew, terrible. It's only, you know, narratively, they tend to be patchy, and they're hard to knit together as well. You know, that's always pronounced. I think people tend to pick one and kind of go, this is the one I like. And even if it's even the best of all anthologies, people tend to take sides on what's good and what's not. I mean, even, you know, you look at something like the Ealing Studios Dead of Night from the 40s, you know, regardless of how good that last episode, that last story is, there's still a story about a person's golf round being ruined by being haunted. You know, there's always that kind of stuff. Anyway, so The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill is the one that always kind of gets pumped up as not being as good. It's certainly a lot slower. I mean, the pace drops considerably after Father's Day, which itself has a slow build-up. Stephen King's portrayal of Geordie is incredibly heightened. Apparently on the request of Romero to just go, you know, really, really over the top. And he does, and it gets a kick in by the critics for it, which is a bit harsh. But because I think that was what Romero was saying to everybody, you know, dial it up, dial it up, dial it up, make it really cartoony. The thing about that, though, and that story, I'd say, you know, looking back on it now, is it's still very much quite a sad tale, and it's quite melancholy, even though, you know, it's got King mugging for the camera, and, you know, oh, shucks, and oh, Geordie, you old lug here, and that kind of, you know, I think notoriously it does have, you know, King, you know, declaring meteor shit at one point, when he describes the alien invasion which is coming down. But at the same time, it's kind of sad, and, you know, it's about a person who dies alone, we say. It's pretty clear where it's going as well. So the jokes kind of guide you along to this kind of like, oh, kind of ending, which I think some people might find unsatisfying itself. And from there, they're all kind of very much classic morality tales until, well, even they're creeping up on you as well, really. It's about a horrible person who locks himself away from the world, and that is his undoing due to some form of... supernatural, potentially aggressive endings with all these cockroaches. The story of the cockroaches is fantastic, by the way. So they realise that they need just a huge number of them, and if you buy them from like a catalogue for a hand, you know, for like handlers, it would cost a fortune. So what they do is they get an entomologist from the Museum of Natural History, one guy called Ray Mendez and one guy called David Brody, to go to Trinidad, and they just collect epic amounts of cockroaches and bring them back to the US and then breed them in a trailer in this girls' school that's being used as a film studio. So they stink the place out. They're awful. And then the other side of this is that the last segment, and I think that segment's this cockroach, something that tied you over, they're creeping up on you. This last segment, they they basically run out of money, so they had to get more cash to make it, which is mad because it's probably, for me, it's the best segment in it. You know, it would have been a lot weaker film without this story, and certainly the one that I remember most when I first watched it, shall we say. So they just get lots of cockroaches and then drop them into a section and turn the lights on, and cockroaches see light and scatter, just as a natural instinct. So that's why all the effects are these cockroaches pegging it. So one of the stories is, well, there's a few stories from that time. They're all on the Just Desert documentary. But what they do is these cockroaches are basically getting out, let's put it that way. So there's one point when the cockroaches come through a vent in the wall, but they basically, the plan is you drop the cockroaches into the funnel and they come through the vent. They didn't. They just came back out and covered the two handlers in cockroaches, who then basically started screaming and running away. And the other one is that... So with the last scene where cockroaches are everywhere in the room, they planned to put Vaseline across the top of the walls of the stage, the sound stage, so the cockroaches would just slide back down again if they got too high up. What actually happened was the cockroaches, through force and numbers, just went over the top of the Vaseline and all escaped. So my understanding is, from a legal point of view, from that production, no cockroaches escaped. From a real point of view, they probably did, which is fab. But not if you live around there, I suppose. It's bloody terrifying if you live around there. So they take the film to Cannes, and they manage to rent a theatre. They put a few adverts in LA Press, and then get the papers delivered and put the papers through everyone's doors to say this show's on. And you know the name's on and that. Warners takes a look at it and goes to see the screen. They struggle to get him into the owners to the screening because it's so rammed and there's so much fuss and bother about it. Again, quite exciting. And he picks it up for Warners. If we're talking about success and box office success, and what would be defined as a success, certainly in your mind, I don't know. But is it just a huge pool of money? Because Dawn of the Dead, you know, has made a lot of cash over the years, but was never number one at the box office. But when Creepshow was released in 82, in November, it actually hit the top spot for 1 week. So... and then maybe it's for its $8 million budget, it's $21 million completion at the US box office probably wasn't, you know, wildly, probably, you know, wasn't a huge amount of success, but in terms of, you know, top of the box office, it was this one is Romero's only number one film and was actually Warner Brothers' top grossing horror film for that year. So let's do what we have been doing, though, and talk about Creepshow in terms of Romero and Romero's style and plans. Certainly, if you compare it to the small thoughtfulness of Knight Riders and the majority of his work up to then, it seems a huge shift change. What I'd say is that Knight Riders showed that Romero liked directing action, and Dawn of the Dead, certainly from some of its colour palette, its blue zombies, its garish, commercial, bright light, and its use of a shopping centre as a foil, it indicates that Romero was not averse to comedy and lightness, and also the use of certainly by the end of the film, the pie fight in the Dawn of the Dead indicates them, you know, a filmmaker more than happy to play about with the macabre, but also the silliness, the slapstick elements between horror and comedy. Creepshow is an incredibly heightened film. It's soundtrack from John Harrison is boomy and noisy. Its color palette generally is OTT, but in terms of shock moments, there are back projected moments where you know characters look at the camera and scream and laugh. So a classic example of that is Leslie Nielsen screaming in fear while with a almost neon coloured rear projected back by a back screen on him with red and black. That's not the only time that happens, though. In moments, certainly with the crate, the room will become bright red and blur and screaming with brightness as well, as the violence, you know, the potential violence and the gore kicks in. A lot of it is kind of suggested. So, Creepshow is not designed for a family audience, but alludes to the fact that, you know, it's comic booky roots. Now this is when we talk about comic books now, I think people think of the Marvel movies, which has very neutered palette, and maybe the comic, you know, all that stuff's influenced from the comics of probably the turn of this century, really, rather than the more brightly coloured stuff of the past. But obviously in the early 80s, comics were, you know, were devised by comic panels. And as such, this film uses comic panels to kind of transition between stuff. Now, a lot of this is the work of Michael Gornick, who managed to inject a lot of brightness and theatricality, if I'm being honest, into the film. It's worth pointing out, of course, that a lot of this stuff wasn't done in post. It was actually done on set. So that's probably why it looks so in your face, but quite organic. The acting is very broad. I mean, even from actors, you probably wouldn't expect that from. So, I mean, you know, for the crate, Hal Holbrook who plays Henry is really kind of, you know, for Hal, very big, but, you know, still kind of, you know, quite contained, I suppose, his performance. Adrienne Barbeau, at the time, was married to John Carpenter, and Romero had approached her to play the role of Wilma, Billy, I should say, really. In the crate, and she didn't really want to do it, but you know, Carpenter persuaded that Romero was, you know, very good, very good director, and he should work for. And indeed, you know, she's very fond of the character in the role, but she plays her like an absolute monster. I mean, she is big in that film, really aggressive and horrible and nasty and bitchy. And even, you know, E.G. Marshall's performance, a lot of that is based on him kind of running around and shouting and being horrible. But, you know, this huge hair that's like, you know, he looks like a cartoon character, I suppose. He always brings it back to this line that gets used that he was telling Stephen King as Geordie to play it like Wile E. Coyote, just as he's fallen off a cliff. You know, that moment you see the face and it's all so big. I think they knew they had something that was good. And I think Romero, in fairness to him, did take a risk. You know, you look at some of the stuff that Joe Dante did in the 80s. That, you know, is after this, really. You know, Gremlins, or certainly Gremlins 2, or like, you know, the Babes, but I mean, Gremlins 2 is the peak of this kind of cartoon comedy horror, isn't it? Which just all massively over the top. But, you know, it's from the same thread as Romero did, you know, a few years before, I think it's fair to say. For many, Creepshow is seminal in their childhoods now, I think. I think that's fair to say. It's certainly in the mid, you know, people who grew up with VHS, possibly, were really taken aback by it, and it kind of could have been quite formative for a lot of teenagers. I know a few people it was quite formative for, potentially because it does mix like this, the same reason why EC Comics were so popular. It mixes kind of macabre, salacious material with a kind of a brightness and silliness as well. You know, a crypt keeper that introduces stuff, you know, so in the case of Tales from the Crypt, you know, that kind of stuff. So when we're talking about impact from Creepshow, what are we talking about? Well, there's obviously the sequel, which we won't be covering on this because Romero didn't direct it, but he did write the script from the Stephen King shorts. And the most obvious thing about that and Creepshow 2 would be that the second story, The Raft, still features... Romero was able to take King's story, which features quite a downbeat, low-key ending, and kind of really kind of inject it with adrenaline and make it far more exciting. And that story is as good as anything that's in this version of Creepshow. And then there's a third one, which was straight to video, had nothing to do with with King or any of the creations, and it kind of got a kick in. Most notably for Romero, though, was probably his Tales from the Dark Side, which Laurel Group produced. He wrote, and you know, he was a producer on that show. He wrote some of the scripts for it as well. Most notably Early Doors with most notably the pilot Trick or Treat, which is a morality tale about a guy who exploits the community and then tries to scare kids on Halloween, and of course, you know, gets his comeuppance. And there will be a new version of Creepshow coming to Shudder this year, apparently, which does feature a Stephen King adaptation, which indicates that, you know, they're at least trying to do something with it. I think there's a point of this, isn't there? I mean, that new Shudder Creepshow might well have a lot more to do in tone with Tales from the Crypt, which again, you know, features elements in terms of, obviously, it's coming from the same comic books, but, you know, there's no doubt about it, you know, Tales from the Crypt invariably was influenced, at least that there'd be a chance that it would be good with this, as well as, you know, the comic books, which is where a lot of the inspiration came from. What we see here is Romero looking at, but still potentially being a Pittsburgh independent filmmaker while trying to play Hollywood at its own game. How successful he can be at that in the long term probably isn't clear at this stage to him, but it's certainly proof of concept that it's possible to use the same crew he's always used, work with people he trusts, increase the budget, and then take on the box office and win. There's also a part of this which is that Romero is clear to him that he wants to do grander and bigger stuff. He's created a production company now off the back of this, the success of this film, which has a, you know, a successful late night TV series as well. He's in a far stronger position than he's ever been. And he fancies making one more zombie movie. So he goes to the producers and sees if he can get enough together for one last spin of the dice, a big grand zombie epic. the film we're going to talk about next, Day of the Dead.
Oh no, not there!
Jordy!
Eddie?
Jordy!
But you're dead. You've been dead. Christ, 3 years almost.
You ain't gonna get in that tub, are you? Stop water there at once, Jordy. Don't you know that? You get in that water, Jordy. You might as well sign your death warrant.
I'm a goner already, Daddy. Ain't I? Got the stuff out of that meteor on me. And I'm gone. Ain't I? Daddy?
Righto. Hope you enjoyed that. I hope I didn't miss anything too glaring out, like some kind of lughead. I'm not going to be able to put one out next week, probably, because I'm away. So the Day of the Dead episode is likely to be the first weekend of February now. Sorry about that. Just the way it is. I've got some got a trip away booked in. So unless I can get some time during the week to record and edit Day of the Dead. I mean, it's not a big job in the sense that it's not a huge research job because most of it's in my head already. But unless I've got a chance to do it, I won't be able to, unfortunately. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, if you want to get hold of me, please do. Twitter, @orange_monkey, Christopher at the Last Horror Podcast, get through to me. There's the website. You can leave a comment on there if you so wish. So, until next time, take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.